Now, on this this morning's Monday Focus, we talked to Kenneth Egan, the Olympic silver medalist. Celebrates 15 years, or his 15th year of sobriety. Kenneth, good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us. I do appreciate it.
Thanks a million for having me, lads. Thanks a lot.
It's good to have you with us. You've been through it all, haven't you? Between the highs, the lows, the battles, the politics, the opinions. It's been a busy life.
I've had a good run at it for 43 years, yeah. And yeah. I'm still alive, thank God, with it. Some kind of a higher power up there that's looking after me. But down to a lot of different decisions that I've made over my life, I'm in a good place today, you know, and that's the most important thing. I recently lost my mum about a week and a half ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Nothing prepares you for that.
Absolutely devastating, to be honest with you. And I'm still trying to come to terms with it, and the grief process is well underway. But, you know, a great gift I gave my mum 15 years ago was to tell her, you know, that I was going to get sober and move on with my life, because I made her life hell for 2 years after the Olympic Games. I caused havoc with my drinking, letting people down. And she said to me early in my recovery, she said, Kenneth, the best gift you've given me is staying sober. And I stayed sober for 15 years. So, you know, the last 15 years of our life have been kind of hassle-free, stress-free, yeah. Not having to worry about an adult child like me, you know.
You've given yourself the gift of having 15 years with your mum too, that's not blurred or anxious or to-ing and fro-ing or up and down or silent treatment here or there. I mean, I think it was a wonderful gift for both of you, and no one can ever take that away from you or her, for that matter.
That's so true, yeah. Like, you know, it's a blessing that I did give her 15 years of time, and I was present with her, you know, being able to give her a lift whenever she needed one, or small little things, you know. And so I have no regrets in that sense. It's been an amazing 15 years, and I've moved and I've grown so much in those 15 years. And I dread to think if I had kept drinking where I'd be today. I genuinely don't think I'd be alive.
Did you, obviously, listen, it's one of the most disciplined sports that you were involved in. And to get to the level that you got to, right, firstly, obviously, you have to have an innate skill, but you have to dedicate yourself and you have to work with the right coaches and all of that. Were you drinking whilst you were actually boxing, Kenneth?
The way I drank, and I thought I was very clever around my drinking, because I was very calculated where I would drink on my downtime. So when a competition was over, we'd have a week or two off. That's when I said, right, now I can let my hair down. And I was a binge drinking alcoholic, so I'd let the hair down for 4 or 5 days straight. Then I'd stop, then try and get my act together to try and get some kind of sense back in my life, and then go back training again. And that was my lifestyle. It's mad as it sounds. I was burning the candle at both ends. The training was horrendously hard, and I trained very, very hard when I was on the floor. But it was twice as hard because I was coming in off a 4 or 5 day bender, like underweight. Normally when you come back to a camp, you're overweight because you're eating too much. I was underweight because I wasn't eating.
Wow.
Dehydrated. My thinking was distorted. It was all over the shop. And you can't even look your coaches in the eye, you know, the embarrassment and the shame of that comes with it.
Mm.
And that was my life.
How did you justify the boozing? Was the blowout sort of a reward for your dedication? Is that how you framed it in your mind? Or was it like, oh, I'm under pressure, I deserve this? Or just something that you had to do?
I'd always drank, to be honest with you. You know, right back from when I was 14, 15, I remember drinking and never drinking socially. And still to this day, I can never imagine myself sitting there having one pint and going home. That to me is madness. So for me, it was drinking to oblivion every time. Now, I would get stints of sobriety for a period of time, but like the longest while I was competing would have been probably, I don't know, 6 weeks, 7 weeks when I was in a serious training camp and then going to competition. But when I come back then, I'd probably drink for a week and a half, destroy everything that I've worked hard for, my body, my mind, my soul, my relationships, people that, you know, would invest in me, and then I'd get back on the straight and narrow again, and then that was just the repeat, the cycle, you know. It was horrendous.
Did Did people give you a lot of leeway? Because I'm not on about necessarily partners or family, but, you know, because of your profile and who you are, and you're involved in the boxing scene, it's a big family, but it's a small family. So, you know, it's just Kenneth being Kenneth, or at that time, Kenny being Kenny. So do you think that kind of masked a bit of the problem?
I think the success that I had, even before the Olympic Games, I was 8 times Irish national champion, 8 senior titles in a row. I was doing really well. I was winning a couple of small medals around Europe and stuff. So I felt I was full of importance, you know, and I could let my hair down, you know, and I could have the few drinks. But when I came back from the Olympics, you know, I said to myself, okay, I'm going to reward myself now. Now I need to let the hair down and have a party. And I didn't feel I was judged early coming back from the Games. But when I went on and on and on, like, you know, coming back in for training camp late. And I remember one instance, my coach Billy Walsh at the time asked me to come in and do a training session with a junior team. This was after the Olympics. Mm. And I told him I'd be there. So I landed in anyway at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning after a 5 or 6 day bender. And we set up some hurdle hops. And he asked me to do a demonstration to jump over the hurdle hops in front of the junior squad who were about 15 or 16 years of age. And I'm standing in front of the hurdle hops and I'm seeing 20 hurdle hops and there's only 5 there.
Right.
So this is very embarrassing, but this is where the drinking led me. And I'm an Olympic silver medalist standing before these young lads that all aspire to be great champions. And I make an attempt to jump over the first hop, just about make it. And then I tried to jump over the second one and I miss it and land on my head. Billy Walsh said to me, Kenneth, get the F out of here. Wow. And he sent me home. You know, that's horrendous.
Yeah.
You know, how embarrassing is that?
After the 2008, after the 2008 success, I presume, I mean, the questions were being asked, were you going to turn over, were you going to go pro? Why didn't you at that time? Was it money? Was it the booze? Was it age? What?
Yeah, like I was 26 years of age winning that medal, so I was in my prime.
Right, you were right, ready to go, yeah.
Yeah, I was good to go, you know, and I did get offers from New York and Los Angeles, both sides of America. And to be honest with you, there was one guy that wanted to invest an awful lot of money in me. I'm talking about 6 figures here. And on the final showdown, if you like, he flew back over from America, landed in the Clarion Hotel here in Dublin, and he had the contract. And I was still drinking at the time, heavily. And I just couldn't sign on the dotted line because I was selling him a fake. And I was thinking to myself, I need to get myself sorted here. I can't be signing contracts, not knowing the full extent of what this actually means. Moving to America and trying to compete while not well. Mm. So I declined his offer. He was very pissed off, mind you, and he went off back to America. But I just said, you know what, I need to get me life sorted. And I chose recovery over the big signing on fee. And it was the best decision I've ever made.
The best decision.
Without a doubt.
Because you've described yourself as a yes man. Was that really the start of you going, actually, no? And maybe because it was such high stakes, it made that decision even more crucial in the person you are now.
Of course it was. And I was a yes man. I was getting dragged from pillar to post when I come back from the Games, as you can imagine. You know, we only won 3 medals that year of a team of 51 athletes. 5 boxers. Out of those 5 boxers, we won 3 medals. So we were hot property, if you like, you know. And I was running around like a blue arse fly trying to keep everyone happy. Mm. That was my problem. Instead of saying, no, I can't do this or can't do that, I was dragged from pillar to post. And within that then, when I was finished doing what I had to do throughout that day, I'd say, right, now I need to reward myself. I need to switch off time, a bit of Kenneth time. And then, of course, I'd be drinking then, obviously. But I let down an awful lot of people from me drinking. Schools that I was supposed to attend, coming back from the Games, you know, not turning up. All these little kids with lovely paintings and signs, welcome Kenny and all this. It was a disaster, an absolute disaster, a time bomb.
But Kenneth, have you forgiven yourself for that? Because that's a couple of times you've mentioned it, and you know, it still feels raw, right? But I hope you've forgiven yourself for that. I mean, you were in a disease, like
I in the program, the 12 step program, you talk about making amends when it doesn't harm anyone, you know. And I've made many amends to people that I've hurt when I know it's not going to harm them, you know. I'm fully aware and responsible for all my shortcomings throughout all those years of madness. But what I've gained over the last 15 years, you know, like, I have a great awareness now. And when I have good awareness, it allows me to make great choices. So I'm in a really, really good, peaceful place now. I have a great peace of mind. I don't rush anything. I take my time. And I can say no very, very easily. No, that doesn't suit me. No, I'm not available. Or no, I can't do that. And I'm okay with that. Mm. Whereas before, oh, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, I'm putting massive pressure on myself to do everything for everyone. You know, so I'm really, really comfortable in my own recovery now today.
Was the booze and self-medicating as well too, Kenneth?
It was just total escapism.
Yeah.
I wasn't comfortable
in my
own skin.
What were you escaping? Was it just being in your own head?
Just in my own head, my thoughts, my anxiety. You know, I loved just sitting there drinking. I just loved that part of it. You know, I loved the crack, the banter, the slagging. But obviously, it never stopped after one night. It was the hangover I couldn't handle. I had to have more drink to suppress the hangover. And then we go again. And, you know, until ultimately my body was just too sick to drink, then I'd stop. And that's when you're in a dark place, you know. Mm. And I did contemplate suicide a few times. And, you know, I just didn't have the courage to go through with it, you know. And a very good teammate of mine, Darren Sutherland, passed.
Yeah, I remember.
He was the total opposite to me. Yeah. He was a professional.
Doesn't make sense, does it?
Mr. Perfect.
Yeah, doesn't make sense.
He was Mr. Perfect.
Yeah.
So the mind is very fragile.
And it's so blooming complex, because that's some juxtaposition there, isn't it? You know, living the lifestyle you did, the lifestyle he has, and here we are, and very sadly he's no longer with us, and so much potential there that we never got to enjoy, nor his family to have him around them as well. So when you were saying yes to stuff, just, and then we'll move on to why you're up here, I'm just curious, you know, did you find someone say, right, can you do this, Kenneth? And you'd go, yeah. But the closer it came, the more anxiety you would have about it, right? To the point whereby you'd be on the brink of it, and then you'd just have to pull out or go on the booze or what. Was that how it was? So you'd say yes to this, that, and then, but the closer it became, the more anxious you became.
So I'd hate to let anyone down. So yeah, I'd say yes straight off the bat. And say it was a week, 2 weeks' time. I'd come up to that date, and I'd be on a high stool somewhere.
Right.
So I wouldn't even give any consideration to that meeting or that booking. And then I'm thinking, oh no, I'm not letting this person down. Oh look, it is what it is. And then I drink again, drink on that, you know, terrible. And then they'd ring you a couple of days later. Oh, Kenny, I had 50 people there waiting for you. Terrible, sorry. But really, was I really sorry at the time? Well, I couldn't give a fiddler's as long as I was drinking,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Deep down.
Yeah. The talk that you're coming up, you're a keynote speaker for this event. It's the White Oaks Centre. Their team, they're inviting the public to a celebration of recovery at Christmas, right? So this is different. It's framed somewhat differently maybe from some of the other speaking events that you do. This is about a celebration of recovery. And do you know what? And just listening, as sad as you are and would be, and I know how it feels with the passing of your mum, ironically, the most joyous thing we've talked about is the 15 years that you took back to have with her. You know, and that's just an amazing, it's almost as big a message as anything you've delivered, because that is just the greatest gift to give a mum and yourself as well. So is this, how do you, this is, we've been celebrating your recovery throughout this conversation in a way, haven't we?
Mm-hmm. Look, I've achieved some amazing things in my life. Don't get me wrong. The Olympic medal was obviously the pinnacle in my sporting career. But my Olympic medal doesn't come anywhere close to my recovery. And I'm very grateful for the recovery I have, because what I've achieved in those 15 years, like, you know, even on a personal note, like the girl I was with at the Olympic Games, I threw her to the side like a piece of dirt and went off and caused havoc. I tried to contact her 5 years later and I sent her a text and she told me to F off, which was fair enough, understandable. But I kept asking her and I kept asking to meet up. We got talking again. And now we're married and we have a 10-year-old girl.
I wasn't aware of that. I didn't expect that story to end up like that. That's brilliant.
That's recovery.
Wow, that's lovely.
You know, but we have a daughter together, an amazing 10-year-old who has never seen me drinking, never seen me drunk, has never seen the inside of a pub. So, you know, my recovery has changed my life immensely, but also the people that I love around me, you know.
Mm.
And that's priceless. So that's I'm there to talk about the beautiful word recovery and what it means to me as an individual. Like, so many good things have happened. Getting back into the workforce, being reliable, being trustworthy, being able to held accountable, being responsible, all those things come with recovery.
Yeah.
Being a functional adult, you know?
Yeah, it was kind of separate, or maybe. What's your relationship with boxing like now?
I still love boxing, don't get me wrong. You know, I work in a gym, I do a bit of corporate boxing fitness and stuff like that. So,
good.
But at the high end, I would watch it. But, you know, boxing was great. I really enjoyed my boxing when I was competing. You know, I got the chance to travel all over the world representing my country. How proud could you be for that, you know? Very, very special. And when I walked away from it, it was the right time to walk away. But I remember speaking to Billy Walsh before I retired. I said, Billy, I'm going to retire after this national final. I'd love to come back in as a coach. And Billy said to me, we'd love to have you in, Kenneth. We've no funding. You can come in as a volunteer. And that was the first time I stepped away from the sport to say, you know what? You're only a number.
Yeah.
You're only, and that hurt. That really hurt. But then I had to really pull up my socks and say, you know what? I need to make something of myself. I can't be Kenneth Egan, the boxer, solely just that title. And I had to move on with my life, and I went back to college as a mature student, got a diploma in addiction studies, went on to do a degree in psychotherapy. I had to really man up and take hold of my life. And that's tough to do when you're in your mid-30s.
It certainly is. Listen, as someone who watches boxing, I have to ask you, do you ever consider what you might have achieved if you'd have turned over at 26, 27?
A great question, you know. And, you know, when I was sitting in that hotel and he had that contract in front of me.
I want to know who it is. Do I know his name? No.
I tell you his name. He was believe it or not, his name was Joey Winters.
Right.
He had sold his haulage company in New York for $100 million.
Okay.
His mom was from County Clare, and he wanted to bring over someone Irish to set up this whole boxing thing, and I was his number one choice.
Wow. Now, so you were the first in his stable, like, oh, that would have been the plan.
Yes, wow. I was the start of it, you know, and he offered me $1 million. There was a lot of money involved, and a wage per week. It all sounded fantastic, but in the small print, it was a 10-year contract. And I was thinking, can I commit to this 10 years, not knowing where my head's going to be at, you know? And I could imagine being stuck in that 10-year contract, underperforming, getting beaten by journeymen, and just being a wash-up.
Yeah.
That's horrendous. But looking back, if I had been sober and I never drank before and I hadn't turned pro, God knows where it'd be. But you know what? Life throws these cards at us and we have to just work with them. And I got recovery, the best thing I ever done, to be honest with you. And now I'm in an amazing spot where my stress levels are very low. I do me a bit of work. I try and help as many people as I can throughout the day. And there's two things I do every day. You know, when I go out of bed in the morning, I tell myself I'm a good person, because I am a good person. And I go out throughout the day not to harm anybody, to cause any havoc, and be respectful. And when I go to bed at night, I say thank you, because I'm very grateful for the life that I have today.
Okay. And it's going to be great having you up here. Again, condolences on the passing of your mum, Kenneth. I know it's really, really raw, but you know what? Isn't it lovely that you've got your beautiful family as well, and hopefully a fully no regrets relationship with your mum, which helps grieving, because not everyone has that either, too. Thanks very much. I'll remind our listeners after I say goodbye to you of when and where you are. But thanks for chatting to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, lads. Right, thank you.
Look after yourself. Bye-bye. That's Kenneth Egan there, Olympic silver medalist. He is up at the White Oak Centre, and their team is inviting you to a celebration of recovery at Christmas. And the keynote speaker there is Kenneth Egan, Irish Olympic medalist. So it's in the White Oak Centre, Derry Vane Muff. It's on Saturday, the 6th of September at 2 p.m. And it's an opportunity, and I'm reading here, it's an opportunity to gather in a spirit of gratitude. And family members are welcome. And just to help with catering, if you are going, please give the White Oaks Centre team a ring or an email to confirm your attendance, and then they know how many cups and saucers to put out, etc. So there you go. Kenneth Egan is an interesting character, isn't he? Because he's obviously very thoughtful and all, but he's very precise in how he speaks as well, too. All right, interesting conversation with Kenneth there. Right, we're asked Kenneth if he would agree with a leading political figure back in the 80s that alcohol was the devil's buttermilk. That's a quote I don't remember. Right, Michael McLoone had a very successful Gaelic football career, says a listener, but it was cut short by injury, as John mentioned a little earlier on. He missed out on the Ulster-winning breakthrough team of 1972 when he would have been at his peak at the age of 27. Listen, thanks so much for all your comments. They're in the hundreds, actually. So we do appreciate that. I'm going to get through those, as many of those as I can, between today and tomorrow. Now, MEP Cynthia Ní Mhorchú is back on the show. She's been accessing more figures, this time as it relates to people jailed for breaching domestic abuse orders. And there has been a significant increase. Imagine why, Cynthia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Walter Roth, Greg. Good evening, Tasha.
Right, so talk us through the figures, Cynthia.
Okay, so I did a Freedom of Information request and I wanted to see how many domestic violence orders were granted, but then thereafter breached, Greg. So the types of orders that you can get are fivefold, according to the table that was given to me on foot of the Freedom of Information. So, first of all, category one, breach of a barring order. Category two, breach of a protection order. Category three, breach of a barring slash safety order. And paragraph, sorry, category, I should say, four, breach of an emergency order, and category five, contravention of a protection order. So let's just say these categories were broken down. The three main categories in the family law legislation that I was familiar with for many years running these cases in court was the first port of call is a protection order, Greg. You get it, it's one-sided, it's called ex parte. So the alleged abused person makes the application one-sided on his, her, their own to court and gets it for a very limited period so that the alleged perpetrator can be brought before the courts to defend it or otherwise. That's a protection order. The next one, next step up is a safety order, and then it's more long term. And the next step up is a barring order, which is much more long term and far more severe. Just to indicate to your listeners, which they probably know, when you get a protection order, short term one-sided order, or when you get a safety order, it does not require the alleged perpetrator or then the person who's found to be a perpetrator to leave the family home. It requires that person to behave in a particular way, bound by the court, and there's a sanction put on them in terms of the wording of the act. And it's breach of that is a breach of a judicial order that brings along a potential judicial action and a judicial sentence and a criminal sanction, because breach of a court order, a judge's order, is a criminal offence and can be found so. Okay, so you asked me about the increase. The increase in a nutshell of these different categories, Greg, from the year 2020 to the year 2024 is 70%.
Which is
Now,
quite remarkable. We have a serious issue on this island of violence towards women, and domestic violence is a terrible problem. Not to say that there isn't violence and domestic violence towards men. We recognize that,
no,
but the
that's right.
majority of
We
people
do.
that are victims are women. This increase, does this show an increase in domestic abuse, or is it sending out the right message? And it's important that we talk about it, that if you are the recipient of one of these orders and go on to break it, you are likely to be locked up. I'm struggling to,
Yes,
you know, to
struggling
take the
to
pros and
grapple with it.
cons from it, right?
Yes,
Because the
well,
numbers are great, but the increase, it means that the breach of these orders is being taken seriously too.
Yes, it does. Now, the pros and cons are as follows. Yes, Greg, you're so right to have a nuanced approach to this. We have to put it in context. So, the years that I got the figures for from 2020 to 2024 were COVID years, and they were also, or post-COVID, if you want to call it, coming out of COVID, but also housing crisis. So, they coincided with those. So we have to put it in that context. And that was a situation where people, victims, could not leave the family home. There was nowhere to go. And obviously COVID meant there was doubly no place to go. So we put it in that context. But however, if we turn to a publication like the UN report of last week, it shows that an average of 137 women and girls are killed every day by someone in their family. And of course, we know from our own national statistics and indeed EU surveys that one in three women has experienced physical and sexual violence since the age of 15. So there's no doubt about it that this is an epidemic. And I'm happy to use that word, completely happy to use it. But I do have a couple of solutions. And before I outline those, Greg, I do want to say that this is two-sided. There are men who are subjected to physical abuse, coercive abuse, controlling behavior by their spouse who happens to be female, or indeed females can do it to females in a marriage, or indeed, you know, males can do it to males in a marriage. But the preponderance of victims are obviously women. Could I also say, from the point of view of balance, Greg, that I have defended men, husbands, against allegations of this nature, and I have defended them against having a barring order applied to them or imposed upon them. Because unfortunately, and this has to be recognized by judges and the judicial system, there is a certain cohort of people, I'm not going to say women or men, but of people who
It's
will
going to be
bring these
both, isn't it?
applications in order to gain advantage.
Yeah, of course. And that needs to be recognised.
Addressed.
And those
Yeah.
people actually are doing the real victims of domestic abuse a disservice
Correct.
as well as that individual.
Yes.
I think societally, there's a massive elephant in the room. And I don't want to get too deep into this, but I just want to recognise it, that I understand there are some people in this country that are very vocal about the safety of women and children. And often the perceived threat might be people who've moved to this country, for an example. And listen, it's perfectly fine to advocate if there are genuine concerns there. But the massive element in the room, and that people won't talk about on a scale or as passionately, is the fact that the majority of abuse of women, their physical abuse, mental abuse, and men, happens within the home. And we don't really talk about it, yet we get all up into a heap, and quite rightly so, with a subsection of this abuse that goes on, and almost ignore the epidemic that's going on within walls.
Exactly. Yes, I agree with you. And that's because the far right, or whoever is putting out this incorrect misinformation, disinformation about violence against women being perpetrated in the name.
Some of it might be correct, though. Like, some of it might be correct. I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong. I'm just saying it's about the level of attention.
Yes, of course, but nobody can speak with authority on that unless they got the data and the statistics to back that. And to date, I haven't got those, Greg. So I don't accept that it's mainly immigrants who are doing it, or it's mainly Irish men or Irish women who are doing it. We need to have the data. But could I just go back to the other point that you made with all that noise around immigration, which I absolutely abhor and call out every time, that negativity and misinformation. You're quite right. Then we excuse away, as a result of that conversation, we excuse away the violence that's happening right under our noses, in the family home of our neighbours next door, of our sister down the road, of our cousin who's maybe in the next county or whatever. So yes, there does need to be a campaign of calling it out. One of the things I'm calling for is on the judicial side, specialist judges, specialist training, speed up the whole process of making an application, getting it heard, getting it tested, and having a very, very competent judge more trained in this area than they are now, even though they're excellent, the district court judges. They're flat out the door working non-stop because of the volume of cases. But the other thing is, Greg, we have to have a robust education programme in schools for our young women and our young men, and make sure they can get the words, the communication skills to call it out. And for example, in the case of young fellas who think they're just having a laugh, somebody needs to have the confidence to be able to say, listen, I want respect over dominance. I have a mammy, I have a sister,
but
I have,
Cynthia,
you know, whatever.
This is only my point of view. I think a lot of that is happening. I think a lot of that's happening, but some way along the line, influences, other influences coming to play, and I think undo that work. I think what we actually need,
Greg,
is more... we need more role models, more people with a platform speaking out to counter some of the toxic...
I agree.
Because
I think
a lot's going on in school. I just think that at some point that is undone along the way.
Can I just say, no, I agree with you, Greg. You're absolutely right. You have your finger on the pulse there with teenagers. Like, I rear two teenagers, and I know, I saw it, I witnessed it, and witnessed how difficult it was for my son at a particular age to actually call it out when I was encouraging him to call this type of behaviour out. But it does move on. Could I just say, with regards to middle-aged men and older men as well, they need to be called out. There's a body of work to be done with them, because we're in the Christmas season now, and it's going to be free season, free reign with regards to domestic violence and drunkenness and overtaking of drugs and abuse of drugs. And women are going to be persecuted. I'm sure they're dreading, a lot of women listening. But older men, the older uncle, the older grandfather, the older whoever, maybe it's a woman as well making derogatory remarks, but let's go with the men at the moment. But they need to be called out and they need to be educated. So where does the education begin for them? Well, obviously in the workplace. So what I don't want to see is, you know, all these policies in work where it's inclusivity and respect for and diversity and inclusivity, but that needs to be made meaningful mainly by the men in the workplace, not by the women, but mainly the men need to lead out on this.
Okay, Cynthia, thank you for your time. Look after yourself. That's MEP Cynthia Ní Mhuirchiú, and there's a lot of men out there too dreading Christmas, and it's about really stamping out it as much as is possible. Anything in that conversation that you relate to or wish to comment on, 08660 25000, 08660 25000. I actually just want to clarify that I'm not associating with the remarks about far right. I think people, very good people, are of the view that or are very emotional about actual crimes that are perpetrated by different groups of people, but they sometimes ignore what else is going on. That doesn't, to me, make them far right. are the people on in the far right, as it's described, that might sort of try and aggravate that? Yeah, of course there are, but that's always going to be the case. It's about for people to sort of think for themselves, not what I might say or not what some fellow woman says on the internet. It's like in the round, think for yourself and look at, you know, is a particular problem of violence and abuse against women over amplified in very small communities that it exists in, and then completely almost ignored unless you're a victim of it or living through it, where the majority of it's happening. And sometimes it feels like the latter is the case, and we try and platform that. Listen, Christmas should be a time of happiness and celebration. For many people, it isn't. For some fellas and for some women, they're going to be dreading being stuck in the house as they watch, you know, happiness turn to frivolity with drink, which will turn to the snap or the change of mood or the comments. And that's a familiar story out there for people, I would say. On housing, does anybody question the 300,000 houses number? 300,000 houses over 5 years, that's 60,000 a year or 1,200 a week. If working a 6 day week, that's 200 houses a day getting built. Who's going to build them? Fairies at the bottom of the garden. Yeah, but we can build 35. We did build 65,000. We were building, I think, during the boom, 65,000 houses. I'll double-check that figure, but it was certainly well above 50. I think it was in the 60,000s. So we've done it before. So if I didn't know that, I'd go, yeah, you're right. Look at the way you've broke that down. It's a great message. But as I say, we did in the past do it. If pension age was lowered, says an emailer, grandparents would have the option to look after the children to allow parents to work currently when the pension age is too old to look after kids. That comes in from Breach. Fair play to you, Breach. I'm going to say this quietly so no one hears me, but I don't want to retire early and look after their kids. Is that bad? I want to kind of, you know, not do that. Maybe go to live in Portugal or something. But if you wanted to do that, that's good. But I don't want to do it. Right, on housing again. Morning, Greg. I'm trying to understand why non-Irish people are being housed before Irish citizens. I know lots of Derry people and Donegal people who are waiting on housing, and yet non-Irish people are getting the homes. How can this be right? Wasn't aware of that. I don't believe Donegal County Council is fiddling with the housing waiting list, because there is a point system that's there. If there's any evidence of that being circumnavigated, I'd be very interested. I'm not too familiar with the process in Derry. We were talking a little earlier on about the GEA has kicked the can down the road in terms of the official paying of managers. John, what do you think? Should managers get paid? Should players get paid? What do you think? Angus Laverty is Public Affairs Manager with Unpost, and it is that time of the year. Good morning to you, Angus. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning, Donegal, on the 1st of December.
Indeed, indeed. Now, your teams are out and about working weekends and everything, which is superb. If you're waiting on an order, it's lovely when it lands a day before you were expecting it. But there are some important dates coming up in terms of if you're posting abroad, and I suppose internally as well, but the more pressing dates, there's only a couple of days to go for some of this stuff, Angus.
Indeed, those deadline dates are coming at us down the tracks very, very quickly. And the first hits us on this coming Thursday, which is the 4th of December. And that's the best possible posting day for parcels to the USA and for letters and parcels to what you might call the rest of the world. That's Australia, New Zealand, all those far-flung locations.
Is there anything we need to keep in mind in terms of what we can post, or does it depend on the destination country and people need to check that out themselves, Angus?
It does very much depend on the destination country. The best place to go is to the Unpost website, and you'll find a section there which gives you some really good advice on what you can send and how you might send it. And that's the best first post of call for people. The key thing is to be organised, to do your bit of research, to get out those Christmas lists from last Christmas, set down and get stuff in the post as early as possible to make sure you get that lovely parcel, that message, that letter, that card to wherever you need it in whatever part of the world you're sending it.
Many people might still want to send a letter or a card to the United States. They have until the 10th. Last orders on the 10th to ensure delivery by Christmas?
You do indeed. That's the date for the US. And this year, as we're saying to everybody who's posting, maybe you might also think of putting a little bit of special personal message in there with your letter or your card, a little bit of Irish perhaps, a little Nulli Conna or Creagh or Cree. Send a little bit of Irish, send a bit of Irish love to whatever part of the globe you're sending to.
Right, so parcels to Europe, which will separate out Britain and Ireland from this, but parcels to other European countries. 12th for packages.
Yeah, all parcels going to Europe should be posted by the 12th. Letters and cards then on Thursday the 18th. Letters and parcels to the UK will be Tuesday the 16th. And then the big dates for Ireland, for home, are we pulled back the dates for parcels to the 16th of December just to help out a bit, and Monday the 22nd for letters and cards.
Right. Now, the important one, thankfully we're ahead of the pack here to some extent, I think, or not ahead of the pack, but with the leading pack, because Awie Hudson sent his letter to Santa yesterday. But if mums and dads and children have yet to get the letter for Santa, what is the deadline date for sending that to the North Pole, Angus?
Okay, well, again, the secret is get cracking. Get cracking now. The best possible date for your letter to Santa is the 10th of December. So just pop your Christmas letter in an envelope, seal it, address it to Santa Claus in the North Pole, stick a nice end stamp on it, make sure the child's name and address are clearly written in the top left-hand corner of the envelope, and on post, Santa and his elves will do the rest.
Wow, exciting stuff. Okay, listen, well done, Angus. Angus Lafferty, Public Affairs Manager with Unpost. So, children's letters to Santa to be sent by the 10th. And all they need to do is put their letter in an envelope, seal it and address it to Santa Claus, North Pole, stick a national end stamp on it, but please make sure that the child's name and address is clearly written in the top left corner of the envelope. So the address is Santa Claus North Pole and the child's name and address clearly written on the top left hand corner of the envelope. So last days for posting, I'll just run through them one more time for you. Outside of Europe, Australia, New Zealand, ETC, Thursday the 4th of December. Latest date for posting cards to the United States of America, Wednesday the 10th. Parcels for Europe should be packed and posted by Friday the 12th and letters by Thursday the 18th. And let me see, where is the internal one? Can't find it now. It's in front of me here somewhere. I'll come back to that in a sec. It's much later. Oh, yes, here we are. Tuesday the 16th is the posting deadline for all parcels for pre-Christmas delivery within Ireland and to Britain and Northern Ireland. Right. We got some lovely nominations in, and I want to read them, but I don't have time and I've run out of time. But here's the winner. I'd like to nominate Shar. Sorry, is this the winner, the top one? No, it's not. It is. I'd like to nominate Sharon O'Donnell from Remelton, who works in Letterkenny General Hospital in the field of palliative care. Sharon lost someone very close and special to her this year to cancer. Not only did she support them through it all, but following her devastating loss, she went back to work to care and support for so many patients and their families who were going through the end-of-life process. Sharon had a heart of gold. She's a mum in a million and always has an open door and heart for her friends, no matter what she's going through personally. I want Sharon to know that she means so much to so many people, and I'm blessed to call her my friend. That's lovely, Julie. Thank you for that. Well, you and Sharon are in the pot. You're going to be one of five in on Friday to win those €250 one for all vouchers each. So stay tuned. More opportunities to win tomorrow. Have a fantastic day, everyone. We got more. I'll try and get to them tomorrow too, because they're actually really quite heartwarming and moving. And we'll have more opportunities to win tomorrow. Stay safe, though, everyone, and stay tuned.